This is the Responsible Note Investing Podcast, and I'm your host, Dave Putz, owner of JKP Holdings. After we received multiple requests to convert our live webinars into audio format, we decided to set up a podcast. Our focus on each webinar was to be content-driven, partner with the guests with the most knowledge and experience in their field. We do our best to try and ask the questions you would ask. Our live webinars cover topics ranging from bookkeeping to avoiding mistakes to legal and so on. Be sure to follow us on YouTube at JKP Holdings LLC, our Facebook page, JKP Holdings, our Facebook group, East Coast Distressed Note Investing, and our LinkedIn page, JKP Holdings LLC. And now it's time to dive in.
All right, we're on. Welcome everybody to the webinar tonight, the call. Tonight we have a local guy, my neighbor to the south here, David Putz. What's going on, man?
How you doing, man? How are you?
Doing good. So just fill people in on what you do, what you're about, whoever, you know, in case people don't know who you are.
Sure. I'm in the first space, a little different from here. We've been buying notes since 2012 privately. Started in a fund and moved on buying it. We buy non-performing first. We do buy a few performers here or there, but pretty much buy nationwide for 5 years or so now. Stay with the smaller market, the $50,000 to $150,000 BPO range. Buy from a bunch of different people and just get through the day by evaluating deals based on value and using the networks we have. And just building as we go along. So The snippet about me is we've been just buying real estate, and notes has been the best way to do it for the last 5 years from our point of view.
Definitely. So here's a question that I have, right? Why are you targeting that fair market, that UPB value, that your fair market value, 50 to 150,000? What's the sweet spot that you're seeing there?
Sure. Anything below that number makes it difficult, because if you're off by your percentage of 10% of value, you can get in a real difficult spot. Foreclosure costs and different expenses are typically fixed. If you're rehabbing a property, or if you need paint and carpet, if you empty the trash out, foreclosure costs, all those are pretty much fixed dollar amounts. When it comes to if you're buying a $30,000 property, those fixed numbers can quickly eat up. When you're buying in a little bit above that number, those fixed that fixed amount becomes a smaller percentage. Mm-hmm. Up to about 150, once you get above 150, we find the borrowers a little bit more intelligent and able to play the game and bill hire attorneys and fight their battles for them. So we find that between the values of a little bit higher than 50, but nothing too much over 150 kind of makes it work out for both of us in the long run.
Yeah, definitely. I understand on the borrowers, they get a little more crafty, I guess.
Yeah.
with the foreclosure defense, instead of, you know, what it comes down to anyway is just it's a mortgage that's got to be paid.
Absolutely.
So I guess you know, we're trying to talk about tonight avoiding problems, avoiding those pitfalls, people getting started in the business. So what's a big one that you see? I feel like brokers is a scary one for a lot of people. They don't know how to handle it, and they don't know how to identify those type of people.
Absolutely. I just dealt with this a few times actually this week, and it seems like every week we deal with this. Some real quick tidbits that I've always used is, There isn't a lot of sellers to begin with out there. Most likely sellers are not hiring people to sell the product. So the best way to detect a broker is to kind of ask questions that they should know if they're brokering product. The two biggest ones I target are, ask them, A, who the servicer of the loans are. If they ask you why or whatever, say, listen, some servicers are better than others. So if they're not that good of a servicer, I'm more attracted to the asset. If they are unable to tell you who the servicer is, I then ask who the collateral manager is, who is managing the collateral file for the assets.
Right.
Those two things typically either trip up the broker or they're unable to answer it. Always avoid if they ask you for POF. I've never, ever, ever had to provide a POF, except for I think one case actually for what of FCI or something like that kind of
It's
thing.
really
But
a
other
real
than that,
estate term. It's not something that's common in notes
nope.
at all.
So those are the kind of things I always tell people. Ask the question, who's servicing the loans? Who's collateral manager? If they can't answer those questions, question the broker. Here's the problem with brokering. Collateral manager, the question was, that's typically a person that will hold the file, record your assignments, and they'll go chase down any issues. Servicers can do some of that stuff, but it's outside third-party vendors. A lot of people use Richmond Roe. We use a different source, but the big thing we find out from people are when you're dealing with a broker, you don't know who actually owns the assets, which is dangerous. I've been in situations in the beginning where I'm trying to chase something down to find out that broker has a seller who's actually brokering, who actually broke for someone else. You don't know if that asset's still available. You don't know what's going on with the asset, and you can typically not get to the actual asset manager.
Right.
I like this thing. You can see the questions. This is great. That pop up here. You definitely can buy from brokers. I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm saying that the fear of buying from a broker can be dangerous if they are truly a broker and not actually somebody who can directly link you to them. The number of people out there that have who are brokering notes is very few. It is very informal way of doing it. Most sellers just directly send you the product. It makes it more difficult. How do they know the property is still available? How do they know details? It just
Right.
makes the chain. So when people say, "Hey, there's no chain here. I'm direct to the seller," to me, that's already a chain.
So it's not like that all brokers are bad, but
Nope.
who is a legitimate broker is the key, right? So like
Yes.
let's just use it as an example. So Bill, I think, asked the question. Let's say
Yep.
Bill, you're sending the tape out and Dave's gonna broker it for you. And now Dave sends me the tape, and now I'm sending it out to my downline. So now when I'm getting fielded a question or someone tries to buy that asset, I don't know if Dave sold it and I don't know what's going on. So that's where it gets to be too far. And that's the danger part of dealing with a broker is you don't know how direct they are to the seller, obviously.
Absolutely.
So unless they have a relationship and you know who that kind of broker is. So like Joel Markovitz, right? He's like a known broker and you know that he's direct to the seller. He's not a guy who's taking a fourth tape over and sending it out to you. So
We've
that's a big
actually,
key.
when I worked for the fund, we actually said assets that came back to us. That here's that list of assets. Like, well, that looks familiar. So.
We got a couple here. All right, what are the issues and questions to ask if buying a note when a borrower is in a Chapter 13? We're off topic, but we'll take it.
So when Chapter 13, it depends if you're dealing with a first or second. I in second world, you can definitely be concerned with that. If there's no equity protection, you can get wiped. In first world, to me, it doesn't really matter if it's performing or not. BK13 performers are really actually highly priced because you're dealing with a sophisticated attorney that you can, if there's a problem, you go to their BK attorney or the trustee and you file because there's a stay from the foreclosure when they're in BK. So BK13, I love those things. They're awesome.
On the second side, I'll talk a little bit towards that.
Yeah.
The no equity is the big one, right? The no equity is the big one because if they can deem your loan unsecured, you're considered an unsecured debt at that point. And you get paid very minimal if you get paid at all. Now you'll always hear the dollar in equity, the dollar in equity. That is the case, right? But it depends on the bankruptcy district, which I'm not going to get too technical on right now. But like Florida is not, or actually, sorry, New York, New Jersey is not like that area, right? It's not the dollar in equity, it's how much equity you have. So if you have a dollar in equity in a state like Georgia, your whole loan is covered. Where if you have a dollar in equity in a state like Pennsylvania, only your dollar is covered. So it makes a difference where that dollar in equity situation comes up.
So Bill asked question, the danger of you might send money to buy an asset not actually be available.
Right.
That's a huge thing with brokers.
Right.
You want to make sure you're dealing with the asset manager. And the best way to figure that out is when you get that collateral file from that seller, you want to make sure the chain of where it's in the ONE, when you pull that ONE, matches the chain it's seeing in the file. Your collateral manager should be able to detect that if you're using one. If not, your servicer will. If not, you're reading the collateral file yourself and say, okay, let
Yeah.
me make sure that the chain from that person to you makes sense.
Definitely. So basically, right, you could send your funds to the wrong person, and you might be paying too much for those loans because they're being brokered. So what do you see in Dave as far as a lot? I see it a lot, especially a tape I was just looking at. Tapes, people are overbidding way more than they're supposed to, way more than they should. There's no way they're gonna make money on those bids. But what do you see, and what do you think people should do to stop, to calm it down and not get too crazy over these loans?
It's a great topic. We've talked about this a bunch of times privately. What I'm hearing a lot of people is bidding is what percent of BPO or UPB should you bid? And we kind of veer away from that whole theory, where we've bid 70% and I've bid 40% of BPO or UPB. And the difference is typically, if there's equity in a loan, you're bidding of UPB. If it's underwater, you're bidding a BPO, whatever number's lower. When people are bidding high amounts of no dollars, it's typically because they didn't do any kind of evaluation through the ROI calculator to determine if the asset makes sense. They're just told you can buy notes at 55 cents or 50 cents, and they just go out and pay for it if the value of the property matches. Where if you're buying a $30,000 property and you're buying at 60 cents, you can get yourself in a bad situation quickly because you didn't count the other costs. So your ROI calculator is a must, but it's something you must build yourself. I always tell people, get in a deal, get in a deal with somebody, watch the costs, build your calculator from there, and ask a lot of questions. So too many people are buying things too high priced. Sellers are getting attracted to so many people getting in the space and being told, just do it, just do it, just do it. And they're bidding it, and we're losing on deals. And we're saying, there's no way you didn't look at the taxes on it. You didn't look at the sewer lien, IRS liens, all that kind of stuff. And they didn't factor it in because they didn't, maybe weren't trained in it. Maybe they just jumped in. I don't know.
I feel like a
So,
lot of it is just the excitement of trying to win,
yes.
like win the bid. But I don't really care how many bids I win. I care about how many that I actually do get and I make money on afterwards. That's more important to me.
Yeah. I know Ken asked a question in jargon and definitely explained terms, and I apologize for just being in the space for so long. If there's a specific term or
Second language.
I apologize. UPB we talked about is unpaid principal balance, and there's also a legal balance. UPB typically is what the balance of the loan is, where legal balance will include any kind of past fees, arrearages, upfront taxes paid, attorney fees, all kinds of different things. Where BPO is obviously a broker's price opinion, which I'm always fearful of. I'm sure one of the guys on the call today can, we laugh all the time. He's actually a BPO agent. We find about 30% of BPOs being wrong. And if you talk to a BPO agent, they'll tell you they were paid $50. They drove by it on their way to their friend's house, took three pictures, plugged into their AVM, just automated value, marketing system, and they plug in a number and typically write three lines on it. They make their $60 and go. So I don't totally count on that, but so if you're paying a percentage of that number, you can be in big trouble real quickly.
The BPO is a tough one, especially in the first world. It's
Yep.
not as big a deal in the second world, but it's what everybody harps on. They always, what's the value? What's the value? It's not that easy, right?
No.
You got to make a decision in a short period of time. So you try to make your decision on other factors as well, not just the BPO, in case that's
Absolutely.
not the most accurate number. So that's why due
Absolutely.
diligence is important.
Huge. Huge.
Right. Gary says, how did your due diligence differ when considering a single note versus an entire tape? It's a good
So,
question.
Gary, a great question. When you're buying a single loan, you're really looking at that individual loan, what you can buy for, what your return is. When you're buying a pool level, you can kind of marginalize that number where you're buying it maybe a little higher here and you're dropping values down on the other side, where it makes sense to pay maybe 65 cents when normally pay 60 when you're buying another asset that may be a little lower level asset and you're buying it for, we've bought assets for a dollar just because it, you know, to buy the whole pool. So we may pay up for a little bit and pay down other ones. So we're typically buying based on UPB at that point and putting the bid in that way. But in the behind the scenes, we're paying based on BPO and making sure that our returns are a percentage. The return what we're looking for makes sense. And whatever the percentage of UPB or BPO is just a result of that calculation.
Right. In a pool, I mean, you're going to change your buying criteria slightly because you're taking on everything. So you're just going to do pluses and minuses with like what Dave's saying. So guess what? If there's a note that I think I'm going to lose money on, maybe I'll put a higher UP, a higher price on that for to lower my tax basis, right? At the end of the year. And then
Absolutely.
on a loan I think is a home run, I might put a lower price for a higher price for whatever, like whatever you need to do to adjust it. Whereas if you're buying a single note or two, three notes, you want all those to be home runs. You don't want to miss on any of them. So you're going to be a lot stricter on your due diligence. All right. Well, for us, I guess, Dave, you learned from one of the bigger guys in the business. I learned from Fuquan, which everybody knows from National Note Group. Talk about how important that is to learning from other people, learning from other people in the industry, coming to these meetups and conferences and things like that.
Absolutely. I think it's key. We all kind of have a different value of what we do and how we do it. Some people are great at certain things, and other people are great at other things. Every, I guess, educator, mentor in the space is different in their own way. I think it's key to talk to everyone, get a tidbit of everything from everyone. We don't do it the same way, but at the same time, we're not all wrong. The way I structure my setup is different from the way you do it, different from other first position people, different from other teachers. I may not pull BPOs and everything because I don't trust them. I'm trusting my values and my local agent, and I talk to three agents instead of pulling one BPO. I think it's key to talk to all the educators, listen to videos, watch them, join these webinars, and go to the conferences and just talk to other investors and say, hey, what do you do? How do you do it? There's no right, wrong way to do this. It's the Wild West, and we make that joke all the time.
I mean, a good thing to do is right, communicate, call people, reach out to people, get a network of, you know, two, three people that you could talk about the business with at different experiences levels. So, or you can go to the Facebook group, like Dave's group is very active. And when people post a question on there's a lot of comments. So you can get a little bit of feedback if maybe you don't know someone personally. I learned a lot from reaching out to my attorneys. I've told you guys probably 100 times on these webinars is I used to have a foreclosure in California. So every time I pick up the phone, I talk to that foreclosure trustee, I would ask him three or four questions about notes, right? And that's when I was just getting started. Every time I called, I snuck in two or three questions before we hung up. And so by doing that, I was able to pick up and speed up my learning curve. And sometimes that's what you guys got to do.
Attorneys are amazing. You find a few of them will get on the phone with you, and you feel like you should bill them because they're so willing to share information. There's some attorneys out there that won't share anything. Talking to servicers, talking to attorneys, talking to all kinds of people. As we both know, our the network that we have is amazing. People are sharing everything anywhere. We're willing to talk. We just like talking. We like sharing information, and we share too much sometimes because the funny part is people don't take action though. So if I give something away, sometimes 50-50, they're not gonna use it, which is kind of weird, but it is what it is. I think with this space, there's so much out there that's good or bad either way that people just are overwhelmed at times. Sometimes just keep it simple, find a loan, narrow it down, and then bounced off of us. I'm not going to go steal that loan because I don't got the time or energy. And I
Right.
respect you to learn because you're not going to come back to me. And this space is small. You get bad mouths real quickly. So come back to my area and go, listen, look at this second. What do you think? And it happens. It works. So
Right.
it's just amazing.
So I guess with that, right, what are you seeing as the hurdle that people get stuck on when it's trying to buy their first note? You think it's understanding the concept of how do you manage something without having to drive to it every day? Or do you think it's the whole, they don't understand how to build out their team to get to work for them, like the servicer, like the lawyer, like the realtor and the everything else like that?
I think it's a combination of a lot. There's certain people out there that tell you how terrible, dangerous this world is, how scary it is, how all that stuff. There's people there that scare people. It is a legal business. We're dealing with paper. It's all we're dealing with. Buying a house outside your area is hard. But I think the biggest thing is that the hurdle is people just afraid of what they don't know. They're afraid of where to go, who to trust, what we feel is good or what is feel is bad. My first buy, I did everything wrong and I still made money. I think now with so many people in the space, it's best to just break through. Like you're asking, where are you stuck? Let just find where it is, talk to people, ask questions. I think people get stuck in certain spots where because they just don't have the experience. There are certain places I get stuck. I call my friends in space and say, hey, how do you handle this? And we're dealing with FPI. I mean, we haven't dealt with FPI in a while. So I ask questions about, forced place insurance when you have a problem. Just ask questions. Don't get scared as much as it may look bad or whatever. Just bounce a question off somebody or team up with somebody and ask questions that way.
So you got a couple ways to get in, right? Let's say you're a person who's running, who's got a job, right? You're doing what you got to do 9 to 5 or what, a 9 to 8, whatever your hours are. You got a personal life and you don't have the time to manage a non-performing note. Then there's always the performing side, right? And just like people get started in the rental business, they start buying cash flowing properties, they get a little bit more courage, and then they start going to some mid rehabs and they go to the full guts. You could work that same kind of cycle with notes because that avenue is there. And then compared to what it used to be, Dave, what did you say you get in 2012?
I got into it, work at the fund 2010. I started buying personally in 2012. But as you said, in 2012, 2011, 12, we're buying at over 40% of value. It was just didn't you didn't buy anything over 40% of value. It made no sense. Now it's much higher. So you have to be more careful.
There was no electronic copies of documents,
No,
right?
no.
You send a wire and you hope the guy had what he was talking about. It's such a different world. So the entry is, in a lot of ways, it got simpler. And you could see Dave's been around for years, right? He hasn't disappeared. So you know that obviously he's doing good business. So if there's something that, you're going to buy a performer or buy a non-performer,
So
you know
we
that that's a reliable person to work with.
I know we've emailed back and forth. Another way to get into the space is buying partial. So if you don't have a ton of money, you want to buy a performer, but you don't have enough money to buy a good one, quote unquote, that's a high price one, I would go ahead and look to buy a partial at 10 grand. That kind of stuff.
Just make more for your money in the meantime till you figure out that note that you do want to buy,
Yep, you
right?
buy, you
'Cause
talk to your servicer, you talk to your attorneys, hey, get a feel for it, and while making 12% of your money for 5 years, whatever it is. Then you go raise more money. Get through the cycle once, and you feel more confident about it. The pricing criteria. I see that question. Please don't focus on what you're buying it at. I mean, back then we were buying for less than 40% of value. I mean, we're talking cheap, cheap, cheap. 32, 34, but this is 5, 6 years ago. Don't focus on percent of BPO. Like I said earlier, buying a percentage of BPO or UPB and sticking to that number can be dangerous. Buy it based on what your return or your ROI calculator will be, because that's where you need to go. I see a question about being a beginner. You can definitely get education courses. There's a ton out there.
There's a
We know
ton.
many.
Yeah.
I don't offer any training courses because there's so many out there. I won't spill them all out there. You can definitely find them out there. But I suggest more teaming up because
Right.
people are get into education and you do more education and you do more education and they never get out there. And then they market everyone for a JV partner to get into a deal when they don't know what they're doing. So.
The recommendations, I'm not going to give any recommendations because I don't want to say a name that I shouldn't say or vice versa, right? So I'll just tell you about there's free resources out there, all right? One of them is right here, MJS Think Tank. So like this interview with Dave will be up in 2 days on the website for free for everybody. All you got to do is log in. Then you got guys like Scott, you got guys like Dave,
Dave
well,
Van
Dave
Horn, there's
Van Horn,
yeah.
Dan Satovsky starting to do some stuff now. So
Eddie
he's giving
Speed,
a little
there's
different aspect. You got Eddie Speed, Dave Van Horn. There's a lot of stuff that's out there that you don't have to spend a ton of money or nothing at all. And then you have kind of like reading material. Like when I go through my Facebook, I go through like the East Coast group as like my news feed. Oh, like what's going on? Some new articles people posted there, new questions and things like that. So there's
I
a
would
lot of stuff
recommend
out there.
is go give you a plug, go to your conferences and just talk to all the educators because they're all selling. Talk to them, get a feel for who you like. They're all personable and just talk to people. You may find an investor that's been doing it for years that says, sure, I'll teach you. And they bring you on. Some of the advantage of teaching people is to get them to buy with you and have more money, more capital to buy bigger and better, projects. So I
I've
think
always
that.
learned more by doing. So I feel like when your money's on the line, you want to figure something out so you don't lose what you invested. And so from that you grow because you
Yes.
ran through some kind of struggle. You were forced to either grow or you kind of let or that deal fell apart. And then if that deal falls apart, it doesn't mean that all the deals are going to be that way. It just means that maybe that deal wasn't meant to be. You know, the numbers weren't there. And
Yeah.
so it didn't work out 100%.
I
So,
think what you do is you start creating systems. I think you start creating a checklist. One of the things that one talked about tonight was collateral files. You wouldn't believe once you get a collateral file, and this space is definitely different, is that once you make an indicative offer, which basically means I'm pricing this to begin with before I dive into the asset fully, seeing collateral files, pulling BPOs, pulling the ONE, which is like a mini title report, is making sure servicing notes are in there, which you find out what's going on with the borrower and the current servicer. What the servicer is saying to the borrower, are they interacting? If they are interacting, what kind of situations they got into and whatnot. You also can pull property inspections where if the property was vacant, making sure it was winterized, it was northeast. If it was winterized, more than likely there's pictures of the property inside. Good, bad, or indifferent. You get an idea of what it looks like. And making sure the title policy. If you ever bought a house, if you're new here, or bought a house, you have to have a title policy to get a mortgage, making sure the title is clean. The ONE
Right.
report just pulls from that point from when the house is purchased to now, but it just tells you a lot. Like bankruptcy files, it just tells you a lot of information. You make an offer, you say, okay, now I found out more information about the servicing notes or property inspections or whatever. You make a better decision with that information and bounce it off people. Again, the space is small. Just start talking to people. You can kind of tell who's been around for a while. You ask a few people about the person. More than five people know about the person, they've been around for long enough.
All
It's just
right,
amazing.
so we're talking about systems a little bit. What's your system when you buy, right? You speak to a seller, you give them your expectations of what you're looking to do. We're going to spend 10,000, 50,000, 100,000, whatever it is. They send you over a tape. What's the first thing that you're doing to break it down for someone who's trying to get started?
So, the first thing you do is, make it simple. Everyone knows what Zillow is. Everyone knows what Zillow Estimate is. Obviously, we don't count on Zillow Estimate, but Zillow is a website that I still can't beat for a map view of what all the properties in the area are selling for. Are they all 100% accurate? No. But it's the best map to look at what's sold And I usually narrow it down to either 12 or 24 months, see what the market is. If the house looks in a condoplex, it's very easy to prove the value of the property. If the property is in an area where every house is a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 1,600 square foot house in a certain area, and they're all priced at, in Ohio for 55 to 58,000, you kind of get a good number on it. Then you're going to sites to find the taxes. One of the sites we use is Nitro Online to kind of dig into. You can look for closure dockets sometimes in some counties, but you also get pulled things like you can get deep and look at permits and stuff like that. You want to basically get an idea, is the house in a good situation? And then we use Google Maps to kind of Google walk, we call it, and walk the street and see what the property looks like. Big maps, if the big maps are usually a little newer map, and look at them, look what the house looks like. Make sure you walk down the street and walk back up. We've seen a few properties on Google Maps where we turned the block and the property was absolutely gone. From one view, it was there. And to kind of find out that in the latter 2 years, the view changed on that street and the property was demolished. So Google walk it, all that stuff, and then reach out to agents. There's a couple different sites out there. You want to get a feel of what it looks like out there. Not all agents are from the Northeast. Actually, people in like Alabama, they're really, really sweet and they'll do all this stuff for free just with the promise of getting the REO at the end. It's amazing. So I would definitely get into value. Kind of plug in, see what the value is, look for houses at the same bedroom, same bathroom, same square footage, and whatnot. This is after getting a tape from a legitimate seller that one of the key ways to see if the seller, you go to the county site, look at the recordings, you'll see an assignment of mortgage, ASM, and you see who the last recording was. Typically, it will show that seller. If it doesn't, you can ask the seller, or you can ask one of us, and we can tell you if that's a legit seller or not. And most of the time we could tell you. There isn't a lot of sellers out there. So if you're trying to find a brand new source, it's very difficult to do that.
And so, yes, Dave's breaking it down for you. You want to break it down. You want to try to make it simple so you could knock this thing out, right?
Yep, absolutely.
When a seller sends you something, and especially if it's going to be small level, like let's call it 10 loans and less. They're expecting you to knock that out within 2 of the 3 days of your due diligence, right? Or at least give them an indicative bid during that time. You don't want to be, and this is important for this is an important mistake or that happens, right, for new people is they request all this information, they request all these tapes, but then they become known as the person that does not close. So then those tapes stop coming, the emails stop getting answered. And that kind of stuff. So you want to be an action taker at a certain point. And so if you have to break down your due diligence, break it down into 4 steps, right? What's going on with the lien security of the property? Are there other liens going on there? Is the lien in the correct order? So you go to Netro Online and you check that out. You can find out what's going on with the taxes. You can find out what's going on with the sewer, all that stuff. For the seconds world, what's going on with the senior lien? That's another thing that we got to check on. You check bankruptcy, you check property values, you check some info on the borrower. So you break it down into 4 or 5 steps, and you should be able to knock it out. And if you just go with that, and there's going to be certain steps that's going to knock out that loan for you. You pull it up, and they got $50,000 in taxes that they're behind on a $75,000 house. Maybe that you stop right there. There's no need to find out what's going on with the borrower. There's no need to check anything else at that point. So this is the kind of stuff that we've done is, we know if we're buying in a smaller level, there's going to be things that are right off the bat, they don't pass the test, and so we don't look any further, we don't waste any more time on that.
Typically, you hate to centralize on these kind of things, but if the street has cars on blocks, bars in the window, those kind of things, or are you going truly and look at crime, crime history on the property?
Really is good with that.
There's crimes with a crime. I forget what the website is. Crimes. I have in my bookmarks Crime Stopper or something like that, where you can see what happened yesterday in the local town, where you can see a someone shot someone yesterday at 4 o'clock. You want a house in a good neighborhood because the idea is you want to be sure you can sell the property if you take it back. That's the fear. If this thing is a 2-bedroom in an area where all 3 bedrooms, it's going to be harder to sell. Even if you can prove value, Selling a two bedroom is not easy in certain areas. Age of the house, making sure if it's a 1900 house and it has stuff added to it, code violations can be all over the place. One of the other big things is take a look at states with foreclosure time frames. You know, what states you need debt license, but also what are foreclosure states time frames? Are you looking at like a Texas foreclosure, or are you dealing with a New Jersey one that's occupied New Jersey? For all those in Jersey, you know, you can foreclose in 6 months if it's vacant for 3 years, but most property 12 to 18 months. Where if Ohio, you're a year. Those are the kind of things you want to worry about too, because you want to focus on Tennessees, the Texas, and stuff like that, if you can buy them at a reasonable price. So those, it's a lot of little things that seem easy to us because we do it every day, but just start your system and saying, okay, why am I focused on this? Create an area where you get you contacts. Maybe you have family members in, you know, Mississippi or something like that. And you just, hey, listen, I want to buy more there because I have resources. I can have them drive by. Use WeGo Look and just look at the property. Look in the windows. Facebook the borrower's name. I mean, you can
Done
find
that.
some crazy stuff out there. I've seen people, you know, a 19-year-old kid rapping, walking through his house. I know the house is occupied and the condition of the property because he's rapping through the house. Like, okay, this is great. Interior pictures. You can see I just got a job or my husband's in the hospital. You can find little things out where it's like, wow, this person just got a job and they're bragging on Facebook. This borrower could perform tomorrow, possibly. Those kind of things. But there the your first thing is just finding a value, finding out for the property you want to get into. Look at Google Maps, see the property. In the first place, that's all matters. Is the how the house looks. We're an asset-based functionality where seconds is more the borrower functionality. We don't pull credit reports like you guys do. We've told we should, but it's something it's a secondary thing for us. They can't
I mean,
perform, I'm taking a house.
honestly, for me, it's a secondary thing also. I use it just because I need to get the senior lien info, so I pull a credit. I barely use a credit. I look at it as I know enough about the borrower based off if they're current on the first and then their bankruptcy record, and I know enough about the borrower from that point. And you can learn a lot, like I've said before, if you go to Metro Online. Stay put in the chat. You can see like they've been foreclosed on the first, and they didn't do a modification until they got to the sale date. Well, now let's say I'm the second mortgage holder now. I know exactly my strategy. I need to get to the sale date because then that's when they're going to pay. They already showed it in their, you know, that's a characteristic that they had. That's exactly what they're going to do. That's the playbook.
In bankruptcy file, you can also see because typically they'll put the value of the property in the bankruptcy file. You can actually pull what the house value is based on what they're saying. Bankruptcy file has a lot of good information, what their
That's
job
a
situation is,
huge one.
car, their how many leases they got going on, all this stuff that's happening. But you know, I use Facebook also to find out their relatives, their daughters or sons. Just do a lot of stuff. But the first thing you do is just find value. Find out the value, see a picture of it. Ask for an agent to do a drive-by. There's a ton of sites we use to find that information. But with systems, we are, you know, you find your ROI calculator, you plug everything through, you find your agents, and then go from there to figure out what the value of the property is, what you're willing to pay for it, add up all your costs. That's a big thing, ROI calculators costs. One of the things for smaller investors is make sure that, and I'll definitely touch banks in a second. When you run your IRA calculator, please make sure you're adding in the foreclosure time period taxes, not just what's currently owed, because most people add in just what's currently owed. And it's like New Jersey, if you're buying an asset today and you have a year of foreclosure, you're looking at possibly $5,000 to $10,000 additional taxes on top of what's owed now. So the comment about banks, I know a lot of people have been taught about dialing for dollars with banks. It's like dialing for, you know, properties that wholesalers do. I know many people who tried it. It's very rare to knock that home run and get a hold of a bank to lend deals. They're just not used to dealing with it. If they want to sell, you can get smaller banks to do it. It's just a lot of work to do to find that golden egg. You're trying to find a source that no one else knows, and other people have more time, effort, and network connections to typically find that golden egg before you do. And if it isn't, it's probably not there. Not saying it isn't. You know, I know a couple people that just knocked home a bunch of San Antonio properties by doing it, but just so many people were suggested to do that. I talked to Brett Palumbo about it. 2% of people get on the phone with someone that has the asset list. And most people who get that asset list are assets that are like, you know, abandoned factories and, you know, this kind of building, church, six churches. And it's like, well, I just want properties. Well, we have all this. So you finally got a bank, you finally got a connection, and it's the assets you don't want.
I feel like you'll have more luck if you just follow the assignment chain.
Yep.
And maybe let's just use Granite as an example, yep. Right? Granite selling a tape. Who did they buy it from? Maybe they bought from another fund. You know, like I used to do that. I used to make those calls. That's the kind of calls I would make. And just follow the ask, just follow the chain. And maybe you can pick up, maybe that fund bought it from a different fund. And now you discovered a new source. That's the kind of calls that I've made in the past. The bank calls. I've tried that years ago. It just wasn't something that worked for me. I found it better to network with different people in the industry. And then all of a sudden, look, I get a phone call. Look, I need you to partner in on this deal with us. We're going in to buy with company X or fund X. And that's the kind of stuff that I've had success with, is just being active, buying whatever is available that fits your criteria, and then talking with people so that if something big comes along, they think of you.
Yep.
Because you're going to come together with the capital. You're a specialist at due diligence, or, you know, whatever that skill set you might be that helps them pull down that trade.
I also find a lot of people get these asset lists and think, well, everyone else has picked through it. You'd be surprised how many people get these lists and don't buy. The fund I came from, I mean, I've been told that they get less than 15 people bidding on assets. I mean, there's been servicers who sent out tapes and they said no one's bid on assets. I mean, don't try reinventing the wheel. There's so many people out there that have lists. Just go through the list, because there's not a lot of people bidding on them. You're either stuck on trying to find a special asset, you know, deal with it from a bank, and they're spending less time on the asset list. People aren't bidding as much as you're doing. So, you know, you definitely walk through things with people that either you know, you connect with, and buy from tapes that are available. It's just amazing how people are just not taking tapes, and you're missing an asset. I've seen something on a tape that bypassed three times that I bypassed, and then I realized, holy cow, I've just completely missed this one for whatever reason. And I bid on it, surprised no one else did, kind of, and we hit a home run on it. It's just tough because people are trying to find that edge. And sometimes just buying what you can get a hold of. Sometimes people are avoiding certain areas because they had a bad experience. For a long time, I avoided Hamilton County, Ohio, because it took 5 months post-foreclosure to get a deed transferred. So Guess what? I didn't buy Hamilton, Ohio for 4 years because I didn't want a foreclosure problem. Those kind of things. So it just
all right. Yeah, definitely. So Michelle actually reached out here in the chat. She awesome. Told Mark that she's willing to JV with him to walk him through his first deal. So look at that. Awesome. Made a marriage happen today.
Oh, magic. Match.com over here.
Yeah. I mean,
you can definitely JV with people. I know Michelle, you know, a bunch of times we've interacted. It's amazing the space is. Pretty much anyone in the space will JV with you and walk you through. And you know, just reach out. We've done a ton of JVs with people. The only thing I tell people when I JV with people is I won't buy an asset worth less than 30, more than less than 50, because of the risk levels. I don't buy a $20,000 asset. I don't buy these low level CFDs just because you can hit a home run or you can get a real big miss. So I veer those away from those things. We JV people, you have to have some money. I've done most of the stuff. We bought three today with JV partners who want to get into it, but you know, they're spending $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 on assets. Just because it's a less riskier asset buying it there when the value is at 80, 85 with a possible, you know, the other thing is people miss out on when you do an ROI calculator, figure out the yield on it when you're buying it. Cause if it does perform, you want to make sure the yield works out. There's simple yield and there's, we post in the East Coast group today, the time value yield, I have an Excel spreadsheet that I kind of share with everyone. Making sure the time value yield makes sense too. You don't want to buy someone a JV partner where the yield is a 9%, but you didn't look at that because it looked like a great foreclosure situation if you need to go that route in the first space. Can't ask a question. You try and cure non-performing? Absolutely. Most of these loans have been delinquent for at least a year. So the arrearages are great. The return is typically good. So you're always trying to reach out to a borrower. You're using your servicer, a third-party vendor, whoever. You can reach out yourself. It can be dangerous, but you can reach out yourself. You are always trying to make that happen. It's a win-win for everybody, and typically a passive loan you can sell off partially or fully in a great manner. But yeah, whenever I talk to my JV partners, the first route is performing and making it make sense. If it doesn't make sense, you just move on. So.
Don't be married to the deal because you want to win so bad. And
Yeah.
it's something that you mentioned a bunch is the indicative bid, right? The indicative bid is important because it's not only, you're kind of setting the expectation of what these are the ones you're going to hone in on and focus on, but you're also testing the seller to see how ridiculous their pricing might be or how fair their pricing might be. And so you put in your indicative bid and they come in and they counter at $20,000, $30,000 more than you would bid it. All right, well, there's a couple loans you don't have to look at because you're not going to bid that high in any situation.
I'm amazed how many sellers say, "Well, we're not going to give you a pricing on our tape." And I say, "Fine, I put a bid, and they give you pricing afterwards." Like, well, then you know what? Sometimes I just put an offer out there to see what their bid price is. Okay, it's like they won't give you a number, but they'll give you they'll count you. Like, well, you got the number
So
anyway, you know?
you gave me the number anyway, right?
You know, I'm amazed how many people just put an offer out there that makes sense and come back to it. There isn't a magic number. One thing we did find that's a little kind of secret is, you know, find assets have been sitting around for a while. These lenders who are selling assets may have 20 assets to sell, but they may have 400. And if they have a loan they keep trying to put out, they may drop their price because their basis is low on it, or they've had it for a while. They've just been sitting on it for a while. Start tracking deals, tracking offers. If you see a property three, four, or five times, throw a lowball out there. They're trying to get rid of it. We bought assets at, you know, 30 cents on a dollar because we bought a property in Trenton, New Jersey. I mean, ridiculous. It was on four tapes. I knew the value of it, you know, once I got into it. Oh, Trenton's bad, but we dive into it. It was on one of three streets in Trenton worth over 150 grand, where most of Trenton's worth like 40. Well, this asset had a value of 40 grand on paper. I bought it for 28. Instantly, I sold for 85 within 3 months. So,
I got a question here. No equity position note on a second. Borrower went default on the first. What are the options? So option number one is let's see if they're going to file bankruptcy, right? And then option number two is are they going to do a short sale? That's kind of the options at that point. You don't want to dive into and put any more money into it towards foreclosure or anything like that, because until they get that first straightened out, there's nothing to, there's no money to put towards it. It's just wasted money at that point.
Keep an eye on that on HOA liens in certain states too. We've had situations where we got a one situation where the HOA lien filed foreclosure 3 years prior. And while we bought it and transitioned, it went to foreclosure. I got the borrower to perform. She promised to pay the HOA lien within 3 months. The HOA lien finished the foreclosure, and I got notice of the auction. I laughed because I was in first position to find out that my lien was actually in default because the person who owned the lien before I did never answered the default letter. So we're actually in default for the whole thing. So we had to sneak back into second position to just have access to the foreclosure auction. So check it. Yeah. All little things, you know, we all have different stories we've been into, but that one was a unique one where I would never have checked the HOA, you know, let them foreclose. They're in third position. Well, they weren't because my lien, whoever owned it before, never answered the default letter.
Which does happen. The sellers get, when they're trying to sell, they're like, "Look, we don't have to deal with this. Let's just get this thing off our books, and we'll worry about it afterwards." But luckily for Dave, he's able to recover. That's why due diligence is so important. And now he's going to factor that into going his stuff going forward is what's going
Checklist.
on with the HOA. Let me just double check this stuff.
Yeah, and your checklist, it grows as you keep doing it. Interacting with people, hearing stories. Always ask, if a note investor's around you, hey, give me some bad stories. Give me some what happens. From, a drug dealer selling drugs in the house to, you can't evict somebody because they have tenant laws because they moved in for a day to everything. Another thing we've done more and more now is property inspections on vacant homes. If that property is vacated, make sure you do property inspections, because if you have a problem, the foreclosure, your FPI, your forced place insurance, needs to know when the incident happened. And if you can't prove it, they won't pay the claim out. So those kind of things you have to worry about. Again, that's deeper stuff. But for newbies, just take your file, look at the loan, get values, take a look at the view, picture of the property, get a drive by, make sure it's not a piece of lot and land that's knocked down now. Get value, look at taxes, go on, the tax site, the county site. You can look at foreclosures on the county site as well. Just county records, or put the state, city and state in, and look up Supreme Court, and you can see the foreclosure data. Reach out to an attorney and say, hey, what's the status situation? And they usually could tell you what's happening with the loan, what's going on, and let them describe to you. And then you can actually take the collateral file and send it to an attorney and say, hey, can you look through this and make sure it's okay? And if there's any issues, I mean, obviously they'll charge you for it, but an attorney will let you know if it's foreclosable or not, or if there's any problems, and those kind of things. Because there's sometimes where there's an assignment missing, or a lounge missing, or the note's not signed, or something crazy, and you want to make sure the paper's good. We're in the paper business here, so.
I've done that before in a complicated foreclosure that I may be inheriting. Before I buy the loan, I run it by the attorney because I'd rather pay the attorney a couple hundred dollars to review it than I pay a few thousand dollars or more to buy this loan that maybe I can't do anything with. So it's definitely a good idea.
I see the current employment for performing notes. It's definitely, you could do that. I mean, you can usually pull that in a credit report. You can look at LinkedIn. You can look at for Facebook. You can hire, private eye sometimes. You can find that information out. But I would say a person could become unemployed tomorrow. Performing notes are risky. They have a high chance of default as well. So, things can happen, but it works out. Bill, I see the question about, hiring an attorney servicer. I used Richmond Road for a long time. You could definitely use them. Attorneys are a really good avenue. They're a lot more money. Where you can, like Richmond Monroe, you can do a pre-file, which means before the file comes to you, they'll review it in the soft, we call it the electronic version. They'll review the electronic for, I think, 35 hours, and they'll review it and check, see all the assignments are there, everything's there. And then when it comes in, whatnot. We have a different company now, but I don't believe they're bringing any more customers in. But you can definitely reach out to an attorney and say, listen, can you review this electronic version? And some attorneys will, and let you know what's going on. You can definitely have servicers. The last week webinar we had last week, we had, Shante from Madison. She'll review collateral files, let you know if she sees anything wrong. It's a legal piece of paper that we don't know a lot about, when you're first getting in the space. If there's a note that's blank, what do you do with that? Is that scary? You kind of find it actually it's a good thing. You can notarize to anyone. But yeah, you can definitely have people hold these collateral files, to review, check out, just making sure they can get to the attorney if need be, and get it recorded. We stopped doing a lot of stuff ourselves, a lot of recordings, because there's a system of doing it, and make sure you spend time that's worth it to you. On stuff you can outsource, just outsource it. They're better at it. They're less time consuming at it. You're doing this long enough. Just don't try doing everything yourself. Use your systems. If you don't have systems, ask. The best way of doing it.
Just build it out step by step. So your first system that you should be working on, if you haven't been able to get into your first purchase yet, which is You're buying, right? What are you doing to break that down so that you can execute on your first purchase? And then from there, if it's overwhelming to work out the non-performer, you could put it with a servicer like Madison. You can make the calls or they can make the calls. So they're giving you that option right off the bat, and you can just monitor the situation and see how well did you do on your purchase that maybe you're able to see the end result worked out through a servicer.
Yeah, and a lot of people ask questions like, what servicer do I go to? FCI, Madison, Lanhome, SN. It all depends on what you need. I'm sure Shanti's on the call tonight. She is very easy to work with. My first dealings, I threw it to Madison myself because I didn't understand the servicing end of it. I understood the diligence part of it. Dealing with, borrowers, what you can and can't say. You have to follow this debt collection laws of how you can call borrower. Madison kind of walks you through it, where the other ones kind of let you do either don't let you touch it at all, or let you touch it very carefully with them on the phone. So I think that people, just get started, but get started with people you can lean on. Bounce the deal off somebody. And I see so many emails come through, ask for JV partners. Just be careful with that. That's another thing I think the people don't get onto it. Because if you do a deal like that and you find a grand slam guy with $500,000, you think you're diving in a great situation, and you screw up the deal the first time, you completely lost that funding partner. You're better off teaming up with somebody you know and say, listen, I'll split the commission, the deal with it. I'll get this guy in. Let me just walk through it or whatever. And work with somebody you already know to make that deal happen. But too many people are JV with me, JV with me, and they haven't done a deal, or they've done one that worked out great, and they haven't got the pitfalls yet. You can lose a lot of money doing that, and you can piss a lot of people off. You want me to keep that? You got that million-dollar guy? You want to keep him around for a while. You don't want to screw on the first deal, just because you didn't know what you're doing. Start with a small deal. People go to college. They pay $20,000 a year to go to college, whatever it is, and they walk out with nothing that year. Spend $10, $15, buy a small second, buy a small first, whatever. And if it goes bad, you're okay,
And I agree with you. I
Yeah.
mean, sometimes you're not ready for that partner either. So understand where you're at, and it's not that, because this person raised millions of dollars. Now that means you need to raise millions of dollars. If that's not like if that's not the way that you're built, then don't do that. Do what you do well and stay with that. So if that's working by yourself and buying one loan every 6 months and and building it up slowly, then that's what you do. If you can handle a situation where you bring on the extra capital to grow a little bit differently, because it's not always faster. It might be sideways for a little while. Because you're taking on more work than you can handle. You didn't account for everything at first. So that's why it's important to work through your first couple of deals. You figure out what your skill set is. Maybe your skill set is your due diligence. And so you partner with a funding partner and then you put it with a servicer. Or maybe your skill set is raising the capital and you outsource a different part of the business. So just figure out what you do well. And then fit your way in there because you don't have to do everything well. There's plenty of people to help you along the way.
Yeah, I think that's where people lose it at. They try jumping in, fund his deals, get in the situation. They jump in, but they just jump in wrong. Just find the deal you like, pass it through a few people, and maybe you find a deal and you bring Meyer because listen, Meyer, I want to do this deal. Can you just JV and kind of help me out? I'll give you a portion of it. I just want to do it. Do a small deal. You just can get yourself in a lot of trouble. And if you bring a JV partner in and you take their money, and they do nothing, you can get in a lot of trouble doing that. Because if they do nothing at all, they're not really a joint venture partner. Just be careful with that. You want to team up with somebody. You really want to do is team up with somebody that you know that's in this space that's starting too. And then both you guys join with somebody with experience, get an idea of what happens, and then go on your own and do your own thing. Raising funds is, it sounds easy as it really
It's not,
is.
yeah, it's not as easy as it is, right? Just raise money. It's not that simple. There's so many laws and rules that
These
apply to
cases.
it. And so if you're ready for that, then all right, go for it. You know, I'm sure you did your due diligence and talked to the attorneys and all that, but it's not as just simple as picking up the phone.
Yeah, just make sure you get a deal that you understand the seller. Talk to them. Sellers are not going to be pushy. If they are, walk. Get in a situation where you talk to your servicers, talk to your attorneys. They understand, you know. I can't stress enough. Talk to the agent. Tell him to go buy it, or he or she go buy that property. Ask about the area. Call local property manager company and say, "Hey, what do you know about this property?" You never know what you find out. Google the address. You may find the house had fire damage last year. Stupid things. So, so.
Dave, why don't you? I'm gonna just go through this one slide whenever it loads up. All right.
All right.
And then we'll leave you off with the final thought for the night. So up next meetup is January 9th. So a couple weeks off here, holiday break, take a little bit of time. We'll get back at it second week of January. The expo is coming up. It's in February. You definitely want to get on that, especially all these people on the call, people who've attended the webinars the past few weeks, looking to get into your first deal. You can meet Dave in person, along with
Absolutely.
200 plus other people. It'll be a great time. Always the number one question I get after the webinar is this recording available? It will be available and it's going to be posted on Thursday. You'll all get an email about it as well. So I look forward to, hopefully you guys are joining the event. Dave, you want to leave everyone off with something?
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you guys in January. If I don't see you guys, feel free. I'll put my email address in the chat as well. My biggest advice is don't be scared of this space, but also don't be too risk-taking. The space is small. Everybody knows each other, and critique your ROI calculator and ask everyone you can find out about what expenses are in a note. We won't give our ROI calculators away, but we'll tell you what the expenses that we do add into it. Put it all together and bid. Don't bid high on stuff just because you bid on a percentage. Bid on stuff you know it's solid, and be careful with brokers. Just kind of summarize everything. I think this is the promo code. But either way,
AP, right.
yeah, I
All
think
right, that's
that.
a. I threw the promo code, guys, in the chat. So
Yeah.
definitely
So
take advantage
we look forward to
of
seeing you
Dave's
guys
call.
there. If you're in Jersey, the night before, I'm gonna probably have everyone kind of gather together. If you are early, stop by and say hello, chat for a while, and then enjoy every minute you can watching the panelists at the conferences. They're amazing.
Including Dave.
Absolutely.
All right, man. Appreciate you jumping on tonight.
Anytime. Enjoy.